to take a look at the character of the prophet Daniel and see what we can learn about his character that we can incorporate into ours. And then on Friday night, we'll be looking at Jeremiah, the prophet, and seeing about his character. So two character studies. We'll finish out our studies for this week. Anybody recognize that geographical feature? I wouldn't either if it were just thrown up like that. I wouldn't know. But it's one that plays a very significant role in the Bible. This is the Mount of Olives, at least one view of the Mount of Olives. Never been there. I just found this picture, wanted to talk tonight about the Mount of Olives and a particular event that occurred on the Mount of Olives. Now, generally, when we think about the Mount of Olives, what comes to your mind probably, first of all, probably, and it would to me, would be the events in connection with the death of Christ, the things that preceded the death of Christ, the things that took place in the Garden of Gethsemane, all of the things that took place before his crucifixion, significant things took place on the Mount of Olives and in this region toward the latter part of the Lord's life. But that's not where I want to go tonight, because a long time before Jesus came to earth, the Mount of Olives took on some significance for someone who was a forebearer of Jesus. And it's in that light that we want to look at 2 Samuel chapter 15, verse 30. And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and he wept as he went. And his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him, each covered his head, and went up weeping as they went. Ah, that's a horrible scene there. David on the Mount of Olives, crying, just brokenhearted. His head was covered and he was barefoot, all indications of mourning. All the people that were with him, they had their heads covered, and they went up mourning and weeping as they went. Jesus wasn't the only one to weep in this area and on the Mount of Olives. He wasn't the only one. He wasn't the first one to suffer agony here. What was David doing on the Mount of Olives? Why was he weeping? Why was there a crowd with him? Why was this crowd in the same kind of mourning that he was in? What's going on in the life of David? This is what we want to look at for a few moments this evening, and some lessons that can be learned from David being on the Mount of Olives. Let's go back in order to set the tone for this. Let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel 11 is, I think, if you're familiar with the life of David, is probably a turning point. It's a watershed moment in the life of David. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, we find this story about the man who God said is a man after my own heart. He commits adultery with Bathsheba. And then when Bathsheba informs David that she's pregnant as a result of this affair, David just makes bad things worse. He tries to cover it up. he brings back her husband Uriah from the battlefield and hopes that he'll go in and spend the night with Bathsheba, and that will explain her pregnancy. Well, he has more character than that. He sleeps outside. He won't go in. Then David gets him drunk. And when all of that fails, David sends him back to the battlefield with orders to put him on the front line. Put him in the most dangerous position he can put him in, and hopefully he'll be killed. And that's what happened. And David is surely guilty of the murder of Uriah, as if he had taken a sword or a knife and killed Uriah himself. Not David's great moment in his life at all. But along comes a man by the name of Nathan. And he confronts David. You're familiar with the story that he told David. And as a result of the story, David says, "I have sinned." And Nathan says, "The Lord has taken away your sin." Nathan tells the story that makes David realize the enormity of what he did. It's just horrible. Not just the adultery, but everything that we just said that was associated with it. It's a horrible, horrible thing. And then David writes, at some point in here, David writes the 51st Psalm. And in the 51st Psalm, it is without a doubt one of the most beautiful psalms. If you understand the background of it, it just intensifies the beauty of it. Of a man who is penitent, a man who is so sorry, a man who is begging for forgiveness, a man who takes responsibility for what he did. He doesn't try to blame it on anybody else. The 32nd Psalm, in the first five verses there, are the same thing, but it's Psalm 51 that really touches us when we read it. And it helps us to see why, this is getting a little off the subject, but it helps us to see why David is a man after God's own heart. Because here is a man who was touched greatly by the enormity of his sin. And like I said, he didn't try to blame it on anybody else. He stood up like a man and he took responsibility for what he did. And so David repents. And God forgives. And David's life is great from there on until the end of his life. Is that right? No, not quite. Nathan, once again, one of my favorite Bible characters because of the kind of character that he showed. He said, "Now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife." I know this is a prophet talking to a king. And he's not threatening here. This is not the language of threat. This is the language of, "This is the way it's going to be, David. Yep, God has forgiven you." That's right. And I believe that David accepted God's forgiveness, knew that God had forgiven him, and he accepted that. Nathan said, "For the rest of your life, the sword will never depart from your house." The sword here, obviously, not talking about a literal sword, it's used figuratively, and the word sword here is used to describe an instrument of punishment. It always is in the scriptures. And Nathan tells David this sword, as it were, punishment from today for the rest of your life. The sword of punishment will follow you everywhere you go. From the time of David's transgressions with Bathsheba and all of that other with Uriah, until almost literally the day that he died, We'll see in a moment. Almost literally the day that he died. This sword, this continuing, ongoing punishment, was something that was a part of David's life because of the sins that he committed. David's life would never, ever be the same again because of his indiscretions, because of his sins. Take a look at David's life as a result of this series of horrible, sinful things that he did. In chapter 12, verses 15 through 18, 2 Samuel, the son that was conceived as a result of this relationship died. And your heart just, in spite of what David did, you see David weeping. He's in mourning while the child is sick. And he won't eat. He's dressed differently, reflecting his sorrow. And then the child dies. And David gets up and he washes himself. He puts on regular clothes and eats. And people wonder why the difference. And David says, well, while the child was sick, I prayed, thinking God might restore his health. And now that he's gone, I'm paraphrasing now, why keep on crying? The child will not return to me, but I will go to him. But still, David's heart broke during that time period prior to the death of that little baby. In chapter 13, one of the most horrible stories in all the Old Testament, a nightmare for any father. Amnon rapes Tamar. Rapes bad, regardless, but here you've got blood relatives, brother, sister. And David's heart bleeds again. I don't know the time period between the death of the son and the rape of Tamar. I don't know that. It wouldn't matter, really. The death of a son, and now he has his children involved in a... We don't want to make sins from white sins and black sins. All sins are sin, but there are some because of the nature of them and the consequences of them are horrendous, and this is certainly one of them. Absalom enters the picture here. Absalom is irate over what happened and the rape of Tamar. And for 2 years, this evil son of David plots revenge against Amnon and finally gets his revenge and causes his death. And once again, David's heart has to break. Absalom, in chapter 15, Absalom rebels. And this brings us to our text, by the way. Absalom rebels. He wants to unseat his father as king. David must be thinking now, and must have been thinking all along, those words of Nathan, the sword will hang over your house. The death of a son, the rape of a daughter, the murder of one boy by another, and now his son, Absalom, perhaps David's favorite, was trying to unseat his father and become king. And in spite of the horrendous character of Absalom, when David learns of Absalom's death, some of the most plaintive words ever recorded spoken by David. Oh, Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of thee? Oh, Absalom, my son, my heart breaks for David. In spite of why it happened, and your heart, for a parent to lose a child, has to be, especially Absalom, one of Absalom's characters that did not have a proper relationship with God, obviously, had to have broken David's heart. Then in 1 Kings 1, we come to the end of David's life. Adonijah, who you know that Adonijah had to know that it was David's will that Solomon become king at David's death. Adonijah had to know that. But he set himself up. Now, one boy had already planted Absalom, and now he's got another one that's doing the same thing. And so while David is on his death, literally on his deathbed, in his final days, he's having to deal again with the rebellious son. And perhaps as David was on his deathbed, he thought of the words of Nathan, "The sword will hang over your house for battle." You ever thought about the possibility of a sword hanging over you or your house? Is it only David that suffers the consequences of sin and has to live with the consequences of rebellion against? It was just one time, God. Regardless of the times, regardless of the nature, we suffer the consequences of sin. And we read about this in so many passages. Galatians 6, verse 7. "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap." We've told this story so many times. It's because you put tomato seeds in the ground, you don't get corn, you get tomatoes. You sow wild oats, and you reap wild oats. Numbers 32:23, as Moses was talking to the 2.5 tribes, he said, "But if you will not do so," that is, if you'll not go back over and help your fellow brethren drive out the enemies in Canaan, "if you don't do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out." You suffer the consequences of sin. Your sin will find you out in the sense that you suffer whatever you sin. Proverbs 6, verses 27 and 28. Can a man, these are rhetorical questions. The answer to these questions is obvious. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? For sure. Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? No. The burning clothes follow the taking of fire into one's bosom, and the scorched feet follow walking on hot coals. You're not going to avoid it. It's going to happen. Hosea, the old prophet, said, "For they sow the wind, and they reap the whirlwind." Eliphaz, in Job 4, verse 8, he stated a principle here. He applied it to Job, but he was mistaken. Remember, Job's friends thought that Job was in the situation he was in because he had sinned. They were wrong about that. Eliphaz says, "According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvested." That's right. It wasn't so in the case of Job. But it was an accurate principle. To think, and I'll be careful not to call any names here of prominent people, but to think that when you're 19 and 20, and I'm just a kid growing up, and I got a right to go out and have fun, sort of a rite of passage. It's a ceremony that you go through, and all kids are entitled to go out and bend the rules and break the rules and live it up. Go ahead. These passages teach pretty clearly. A sword will hang over that young man or that young woman's life. And eventually, they'll pay the price. What is the sword that can hang over your house as a result of sin? For one thing, mental anguish. At some point in most people's lives, they grow up and they realize, oh, like David, I've messed it up. I've really done bad. Paul, 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 13. I was formerly a blasphemer and a persecutor and a violent aggressor. Ever do a word study of Paul and the kind of man he was prior to becoming a Christian? He was a violent, egomaniacal murderer until Damascus. Up till that point, he lived on the blood of Christians. Nothing thrilled Paul more than to take their lives. And he admits it, not just here, this is in other places. Paul becomes a Christian. And for the next, I don't know what, 10, 15, 20 years, he goes on these preaching tours that are recorded by Luke in the book of Acts. You think that Paul ever preached in a congregation someplace, and when he stood up, he looked out and, oh my, there's a woman who I caused to be a widow. I killed her husband. There are some kids back there don't have parents because I took them life. I don't think there's anything hypothetical about that. I have all ideas. That happened to Paul at some point in his life, in his tragedy. Paul's hatred for and his murder of Christians was something that he got forgiveness for. No question about that. But it was something that he never forgot. And as David, who as we'll see in a moment, said, my sin is ever before me in Psalm 51. Paul's sin was ever before him. He was reminded of it on a fairly frequent basis. Mark chapter 14, verse 72. Mark records this very notable incident in the life of Peter, denying the Lord as the Lord told him that he would. And immediately, Mark says, a rooster crowed a second time, and Peter remembered. And Peter remembered how Jesus had made the remark to him, before a rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he began to weep. I don't think we have a clue of the kind of weeping that Peter did on this occasion. It had to have torn Peter's heart up, as it did David's, what he had done. The mental anguish here must have been intense. But think about this. However much longer Peter lived, and we don't know that, but or however much longer Peter lived, another 20 years, say. Do you think that in that 20-year period that Peter ever heard a rooster crow again? I think he did. I have all ideas. do you think went through the mind of Peter for the rest of his life every time he heard a rooster crow? You think he had blocked it out of his mind? A lot of things I wish I could block out of mine. Can't do it. From time to time, things come to my mind that I wish I could just forever shut out. Maybe that's the case with you. I have all ideas. That was the case with Peter. When 5, 10, 15 years later, he hears a rooster crow in the distance, and he remembers. Yeah, I remember that night. Never will forget it. And David had to have those moments also. From the time Nathan talked to him until the day that he died. Young people, it's, and not just young people, but in our youth, we can do things. The old Debbie Boone song, "You Light Up My Life," whether you like it or not, but there's a phrase in that song that it can't be wrong when it feels so right. No show of hands on this, but how many times have you done something thinking it can't be wrong because it feels so? And later on, you just think, how in the world could I have done it? And when we're 15, 18, 20, 25 years old, we're out having fun, as we are told to have in the latter part of Ecclesiastes chapter 11, defined by God's parameters. But whenever you ignore God's parameters for having fun, and you go out and you just give vent to anything you want to do, it could be another 5, 10, 15, you see that person. You go to that place. And you have a problem looking that person in the eye because of what you did. Could be anything. I'm not saying any particular thing. Could be anything. And for the rest of your life, you live in mental anguish. And you wish you could turn back the clock and not do it again. You can't do it. That's just one sower. Look in 1 Samuel chapter 16. I'm not going to read all of these passages that are on the screen. But in chapter 16 and verse 14, the record said, "Now the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him." The word spirit here, the first uses of it in this verse, is capitalized in a lot of translations, giving the idea of the Holy Spirit, but I don't think that's proper. The word spirit in both places here refers to an attitude or a disposition. There was a time in Paul's, in the life of Saul, King Saul, that he had the spirit of the Lord. He had a disposition that the Lord favored, and Saul had a good disposition toward the Lord. But he let his ill will, he let his hatred for David overrule that. And here it says that the spirit of the Lord departed from him. That is, he no longer had a spiritual disposition. And an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Demon possession? No, I don't think so. A lot of people put that here, but I don't believe he's talking about demon possession. Let me try to illustrate this. Those of you that are or have been parents or grandparents, you know your kids pretty well, don't you? And you can look at their faces. You can tell by their disposition whether or not they've done something wrong. They have a problem looking you in the eye. They get in a foul mood. And with our kids, it was pretty obvious when they had done something wrong. Their disposition changed. They misbehaved because they knew they were wrong. This evil spirit from the Lord, I believe, is just that. Saul knew that his hatred for David was wrong. And not just that, other things that he had done in violation of God's will. Over a period of time, he had violated God's will with the Amalekites and other situations. Just gone against God. And he knew it was wrong. And he took it out on everybody but himself. He was angry. He was a madman. This evil spirit from the Lord doesn't mean that the Lord gave it to him and he had no control over himself. Not at all. It was a natural consequence of violating God's will. That's what it means that an evil spirit from the Lord came to him. It was from the Lord in the sense that he violated God's will, and it came. You go over to a bathtub full of water, you hold an electrical appliance in this hand, and you step into the bathtub. What is it that is going to naturally occur? Lights out. That's it. Happens here. You violate God's will successively, as Saul did, and there are consequences that naturally come. And so one of the swords hanging over our house whenever we violate God's will is not only the mental anguish of remembering things, it's a change of demeanor, it's a change of disposition. We're hard people to live with, and it's all because we knowingly have gone against the will of God. Sometimes that sword involves physical suffering or death. Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs is the, if you want it, and I've encouraged, this is not too far off the subject, I've encouraged parents to talk to their children about sex and use the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is the best sex education manual ever written, in my opinion. So much here about the subject that we could use in teaching our children, boys and girls and grandsons and granddaughters. Just, it's just filled with so many, and all of chapter 7. But here is this idiot of a man who allows himself to be seduced by this woman. Verse 21 says, with her many persuasions she entices him. With her flattering lips she seduces him. Suddenly he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver. Graphic language. As a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. Remember, the woman here said, come on, husband's out of town. Won't be back for a long time. Guess what? Husband showed up early. He didn't like what he saw. And he killed this guy. Happens every day. Romans chapter 1. Unpopular verses nowadays with the attempts by homosexuals to spread their lifestyle everywhere they can. Paul said, for this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another. Men with men, committing indecent acts, and now notice, and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. I think at least one of the things that he's talking about here are the consequences, the physical consequences, of engaging in that kind of conduct. You're not going to do that without suffering consequences. How many people have died or have contracted horrible, horrible diseases, all because they decided to pull a David and go out and have some fun?
not talking just about an affair, a lot of things, and wind up dead or physically ill. That happened to everybody else, of course. It won't happen to me. Understand? And it doesn't happen when you're 15 years old. It don't happen then. It happens to other people at other ages.
Right.
Yeah. And then, one of the things that happens when we decide that we're going to go against God's will, and the sword hangs over our house, it may hang over the house of other people. Go back to Genesis chapter 34. Horribly sad story. Of Shechem, who saw Dinah and fell in lust with her, not love, fell in lust with her, and he forcefully had sex with her, raped her. You know the rest of that story, how it was that later he decided he wanted to do the honorable thing and marry her. He sought permission and received it upon the condition that all the men be circumcised. And they agreed, all the Shechemites agreed, yeah, circumcised. And they were. And while the men were suffering physically from the procedure of circumcision, Simeon and Levi went in to where they were and killed every single male in vengeance for what had been done to their sister. Jacob, their father, finds it out in verse 30, Genesis 34. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites, the Perizzites. And my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." Now, I want you to focus upon this phrase, "You made me to stink." Young people, do you know how long it takes for your parents to establish a good reputation in the community? A long time. A long time. Many, many years of proving themselves as good, solid, righteous, godly people. Do you know how long it takes for you to tear that down? 30 seconds. A minute. In some act of indiscretion, could be anything. And it becomes public. It gets back to your daddy. Comes back to your mama. And your parents say, "You know what you've done? Besides impacting your relationship with God, you made us to stink in the town. You made us to stink." That's what happened here. Not worth it. Whatever fun you want to have that's against God's will is not worth it. When you consider the passages that we looked at that talk about the absolute assurance that you'll pay. And these are some. These are not the only ways, but these are some of the ways which you might pay on your decision to be indiscreet and to ignore God's will. Obviously, the lesson from the Mount of Olives is there are consequences, not only to yourself, but to other people when you decide to commit sin. Remember the Mount of Olives as it is connected with the Lord and all that went with those events prior to the crucifixion. That certainly should be paramount. But when we're out having our fun, not just the young ones, but the old ones too, don't forget the Mount of Olives.
the lesson from the Mount of Olives, there are consequences to sin. And let those consequences keep you from being where David was, crying, weeping, going up the Mount of Olives. The primary consequence of sin, the worst one, is what it does to your relationship to God. It causes a barrier between you and God. Well, who's here tonight that may need to make some corrections in their life? Could be. If you've done something private that's against God's will, no need to come here and tell people publicly what you've done private. You go home and you get it right with God. Make it right. If you want to come forward and in some public way acknowledge you're wrong or be baptized to get that sin out of your life, why don't you do it now while we stand and sing?